Well, greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. My name is James White, and we have a lot to cover today. It is just 10 days before Christmas 2015, and so we're sort of got a little celebration going there. Christmas is such a colorful time, I think, and now y'all have seen this Coogee before. One of the pictures of me teaching from back in Owensboro back in like 2010 or 2011, I think it was. I'm wearing this one that people have called the Coogee of many colors and things like that. But most Coogees are like this. This one's particular. I couldn't be out Coogee today. But I'm joined in studio today by, you have a lot of titles, but pastor, elder, video game character. Putting those together is rather interesting. But Jeff Durbin, there's Jeff.
Yes, you can't miss me today.
No. Well, you know, I'm a cyclist. It's good to be seen.
Yes, that's right.
Some people still don't see you because they're texting.
Yeah.
Is, if I'm ever taken out, it's what's going to be. it's sad, but I see it all the time. If you all of a sudden back in the lane. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. Jeff, you tell us a little about your ministry. What you're up to?
Well, Apologia Church is the church that I'm a pastor at.
Yeah,
No, I'm in your studio now at Enos Schulwasser. So, like, Apologia Church is the church I'm a pastor at, and Apologia Radio and TV are ministries of Apologia Church, outreach and proclamation arm of Apologia Church, using media and everything to bring the gospel around the globe. So that's what I do.
And you all are very, very, very involved in pro-life work, rescuing the unborn and things like that.
Yep.
You hang with some odd people, I'll be honest with you.
Like me. Like you.
And you hang with you have a small C Catholic thing going on, broad spectrum of
yes things. I have a lot of, I mean, like my Presbyterian buddies.
Yeah
I got a lot of Presbyterian
and your theonomous buddies.
I do have a strange spectrum of friends.
Definitely.
I have friends that wear very interesting clothes.
That's right.
And gift me with very interesting clothes.
There you go.
This is a party. It's a Christmas shirt, and it's also a safety vest.
That's right. You can use it while digging trenches next to the road. So
that's right.
Wouldn't be good to do that. We actually are here. This isn't the most holiday-ish topic that we're going to be. In fact, it's not really holiday-ish at all.
No.
Now that I think about it. But I don't remember who did it. If you were the one... What? Oh. Okay. If you were the one who sent this to me, either on Twitter or Facebook, I don't remember. Sorry, I get so many things, I can't remember who did what. But someone sent me a link to a video on YouTube by Noah Adam.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know, because that's backwards. It should be Adam Noah, chronologically speaking.
That's right.
Biblically speaking.
Timeline.
A timeline thing, yeah. But Noah Adam, whom, I'll be honest, had not seen before or heard of before or anything like that. It was new to me, but what caught my eye was a critique. And I just need you to confirm, you're a presuppositionalist?
I am.
It's
a little known fact.
I was speaking at this church in London once, and I got them preaching, and this lady traps me in this hallway, and it's old church, you know. Everything in London is old. And she comes up to me and she says, I loved your sermon, but someone told me you believe in limited atonement? And it's just like that. You know, sort of like if you say yes, she's going to break down weeping. She's going to forget everything you just said. She's going to hit you with her purse, something along those lines. But Noah Adam has a problem with you being a presuppositionalist.
Yeah.
Now, why are you causing division by being a presuppositionalist?
Well, you know, I it's interesting because when, you know, obviously I'm not jealous for the term presuppositional. If someone wants to say covenantal or reformed apologetic, I honestly think the best way to describe presuppositional apologetics is it's just Christian apologetics. And and I know someone will say, wait a second, we're all Christians, we don't do apologetics. What I mean by it's Christian apologetics is that it's consistent Christian approach to the world, to thinking, to knowledge, to metaphysics, to ethics. What it's standing consistently as a Christian. That's essentially what it is the Word of God. Is the reference point. God himself is the reference point, and we're reasoning consistently with what our foundations are.
So you're actually saying that we should do apologetics not based upon man's philosophy or starting with man, but we should do apologetics based upon the idea that God has spoken and has given us the framework in which we are to understand the world around us.
That's right. That's right. So it's theology before, quote, philosophy. Although
revelation before man's thought.
That's right.
So that would require us to believe, first of all, that we believe in a creator who communicates.
That's right.
A creator has a purpose and intention that he's working out in this world. And that mankind is to man, he bears the image of God, is able to understand God's revelation, and has some kind of responsibility as the creature of God to live in light of his creator's revelation and will for him, his law, his what his purpose is, so on and so forth. It sounds like what you're saying is if you start with the biblical God and a truly biblical view of man, this is what follows.
That's right.
But the atheist doesn't agree. But wait a minute, from a Christian perspective, that really wouldn't matter that much because he's still the creature of God.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying is we're not inviting the unbeliever to judge God?
That's right.
But everybody does that.
Yeah. And Christians that do it are acting inconsistently with their commitments.
Wait a minute. Evidence demands a verdict.
Yeah. Evidence.
And more evidence demands more of a verdict.
Yeah. And here's the thing that's important. When someone talks about the distinctions between presuppositional versus evidentialist, someone might initially leap into that conversation and say, so what you're saying is that, like, we don't look at evidences? And it's no, you can't even talk about the world of evidences. You can't talk about science. You can't talk about things like induction in a uniform universe. You can't talk about laws of logic without a coherent foundation. This is the point. Certain things have to be true about the world in order to make a coherent claim to science or logic or ethics. Certain things have to be true about the world. And what we're saying is, as I think thinking consistently as Christians, is that if you don't start with God as the reference point, you don't get those things that are true about the world. Now, the atheist, because he's in God's image, because he is a creature, will live in the world operating like an image bearer of God. He has to, because the world is what God made it to be. And that atheist is what God made him to be, image of God. And so it's inescapable. You can't help being what God made you to be. And so the atheist is going to borrow from God's revelation consistently every day of his life because this is God's world.
It's God's world. So what you're saying is he can't create a consistent existence around him without having to snatch at snippets of the reality that he himself is denying.
Yeah.
He can't live consistently.
He's going to have to bite off pieces of the Christian worldview every day that he lives. And he can't now he may develop a very sophisticated system. You know, there are people, as R.C. Sproul said with Bonson in their discussion, there are people with formidable intellects that are unbelievers, but they are so much just systems of futility because at every turn they're going to ultimately collapse. An unbeliever can't operate consistently in the use of science or in a discussion about ethics.
Oh, you said a no unbeliever can be a scientist?
Well, unbelievers absolutely can be scientists, and they are scientists.
Well, but some people heard you say that.
Yeah, yeah, that's not what I said. Unbelievers cannot provide a coherent foundation for science. Now, but wait a minute, there are atheist scientists. Of course there are, because they're in the image of God, and this is God's world. because it's uniform, because it actually displays constantly God's governance of it. But the unbeliever can't provide any intelligible answer or justification as to how we can actually pursue science in a meaningful way. So Dawkins is a brilliant scientist. He's an intellectual man. But if you actually take what he says about the world, it doesn't match what he's doing in the world. And that's the point.
And he
won't live consistently with it. And here's the thing that's important for people to grasp, too, is that, and this is a good to start, I think, laying down as we discuss this, is that presuppositional apologetics is not, you know God exists, nanny, nanny, boo-boo. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Yes, you do. No, I don't. That's an aspect of what we say to the world, is that God is so clearly known by everybody that you're without excuse and you know the God that we're talking about, and there's a suppression going on. But that's not the apologetic. That's not the sum of it. That's an aspect of it. And so what we're saying ultimately is we have to think consistently as Christians in terms of what Jesus says about himself. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus gives us the famous scene that we sing about in church as little kids. Although I wasn't in church as a little kid. I heard about this. Jesus says...
I'll let you know if this is true.
Okay, he says there are two people with two foundations and two destinations. Mm-hmm. There's a wise one, a foolish one, and he says there's a rock and there's ultimately sand. Yeah, so I'm right about that. Yeah. And he says... he says that one ends in desolation and one makes it through the storm. Mm-hmm. When the issues of life come, and they will come, the one that's built on the rock makes it through the storm. Okay. Now, it's interesting to note that when Jesus says this, the immediate response of those who heard him was, he speaks as one having authority. And they caught it. He didn't ask for any corroboration. He didn't ask for anybody to sign his papers to give him a stamp of approval.
Didn't call any rabbis.
That's right. He didn't actually appeal to any rabbis or anybody above him or say, it's because of this over here. He just said, this is the way of life. There's foolish people. There's wise. There's foundation over here and over here. There's one that's going to make it through. And the one that builds their life upon his word is the one that makes it through.
Right.
And that is what Van Til said, where the whole issue of epistemology and apologetic rests. It's there. This is where it begins.
Come on, Jeff. How in the world are you ever supposed to get into the academy and make an impact in the academy when you're making such wild claims as if Jesus is like the creator of everything and that all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in him? I mean, how are we ever supposed to really get anywhere? I mean, it sounds radically Christ-centered here.
Yeah. Sounds very Christian, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And that's just the thing I think we struggle with as Christians, is we want to be liked by the world. And, you know, I think we need to note very carefully Jesus when he says, "Woe to you when all people speak well of you." If that's what we're pursuing in life, if that's what we want is the approval of men, then we're going about it backwards. It's a moral issue. And in the end, we're philosophically inconsistent. The Apostle Paul says in Galatians, when he's dealing with an issue of a false gospel, he says, "Am I still trying to please men or God? If I was trying to please men, I would not be the slave of Jesus." And we have to ask ourselves the question, do we want to be slaves of men or of Christ?
And we want to be slaves of Christ in all aspects of life, not just in quote-unquote religious aspects.
That's right. And this is the thing, is that the Christian worldview is all-encompassing. Jesus is Lord over all. He says, "I have all authority in heaven and on earth."
You know, with that beard, you're a radical.
Thank you. Jesus says... He says, "All authority in heaven and on earth." I take that to mean all authority now on earth. And so that means that Jesus has authority over the sciences. Jesus has authority over literature. Jesus has authority over poetry. Jesus has authority over media. He has authority. And so there's not any place, that any realm or sphere that he is not in charge of, that he doesn't directly speak to. And so, but one thing I want to note, though, and this is important, and people can look this up. When you look at the history of the Christian church, moving throughout time to where we're at today, it was the Christian church that birthed or gave rise to these great moments in modern science, getting a pop, education. When you look at things like Cambridge, Oxford, Yale, Harvard, these were not institutions that were given to us on the basis of an atheistic framework.
No, they weren't. No. The name of Christ is still chiseled in the walls, though his name is no longer known in the halls.
That's right. And you know, you'll have, you know, things people walk over in these universities, or walk under, I should say, in these universities, that say things like, in his light we see light.
Mm-hmm.
Though they've abandoned their commitments to Christ, they cannot shake the biblical worldview. And so when someone says, well, you're not going to make it in the academy now because they don't respect that. Well, in the end, again, are we slaves of men or God? And do we want as Christians to have an apologetic that is rigorous, biblical, morally responsible as Christians, and philosophically consistent? Because if we pretend neutrality as Christians, I think that's a moral issue for us as Christians. It's a moral issue. Christ is, we're supposed to be for Christ and not against him in all things. And I think philosophically, we break down and become inconsistent when we step off of our commitments that are based upon God's self-disclosure, his revelation of himself. When we abandon those commitments, we fall into philosophical inconsistency. Because like you said at the beginning, if man is the reference point, if I'm the reference point, if we are the reference point, then we don't get to talk in a meaningful way about science, ethics, and logic. We don't get to talk about worldview. We don't get to talk about distinctions. We don't get to talk about laws of any sort. And so even the Christian apologist who doesn't start all of his thinking with Jesus cannot make a coherent appeal to all these things that are necessary to have a debate.
And the key is the coherence. Not that they don't make an argument.
That's
it's
right.
Just that there's going to be holes and flaws in it.
That's right.
Well, now we have started off with sort of an introduction to these things, but we'll get into these things. We're going to start on the video. My primary purpose is the first section of the video is what he... what he called the at one point the exegetical foreplay. At one point, now there is something we got to talk about.
Yes,
I had never heard of this fellow before.
Me neither.
Didn't know anything about him, and so I listened. I didn't watch the video. I listened to the presentation, and to all of the presentation in one shot. I was doing a long run, so I just listened to it during a run. And I was confused. Because on the one hand, he would talk about critiquing you, feeling that you're that the presuppositional methodology of apologetics drives people away from the gospel. Many people have taken the trip to secular city as a result of presuppositional apologetics and all the rest of stuff. And so the only context I could give that, an atheist wouldn't care about these things, wouldn't be talking about these things.
Yeah.
So my assumption from the start is that this is simply an evidential apologetic. But then as I get farther and farther into it, at one point, I remember right where I was on the trail where I was running, at one point I went, if I do a review of this, I'm going to call it the pagan Christian apologetic. Because the epistemology and the worldview was not distinctively Christian. It was pagan. And many of the arguments being made were the same arguments that you get from atheists and things like that. It did not show any self-conscious understanding of a meaningful Christ-centered worldview.
Yeah.
But then I got toward the end and I started, and I picked up on some language and things like that. And I'm like, is this guy even a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about it. I go, wait a minute, if you can go through an entire, I think it's like 44-minute presentation, and that is not clearly stated one way or the other, it takes an effort to do that.
No, you got to work hard at it.
You got to work hard at it.
Yeah.
You got to work hard at it. And so I went on YouTube, and I did something I don't like to do. I do not like commenting on YouTube. I don't have comments available on my videos for the very reason that I was wasting my life years ago deleting all the profanity from atheists off of my YouTube channel. And so I just asked the question on the video, are you a Christian? I got an interesting response back, but basically other people posted links, things like that. He's an agnostic. He's evidently lost his faith. I mean, for 10 years, he was doing, quote-unquote, evidentialist apologetics. I don't know what kind of a church. I don't know anything about it, which would help me a lot. It would help me a lot. I don't think he feels that that's relevant,
yeah.
But it would help me a lot. And so when people, a number of other people commented when listening to this, because I said, listen to this video before we get started, they also were very confused.
Yeah.
Because there was no clarity about the perspective from which he was coming from. Now, his argument is, well, if it's a valid argument, it doesn't matter what my background is. And of course, from my perspective, no, I'm sorry. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. If you're going to... I don't even invest time, to be honest with you, in folks who will not be clear and open, honest, and forthright about the actual position that they are seeking to promote. Because if you don't know that, it will always lead to misunderstanding, miscommunication, a waste of time down the road.
Yeah.
Don't want to go there. But it really made this video very... You know, I listened to it again. Was it this morning? No, on my ride yesterday. Now knowing the background,
mm-hmm.
and it changed the flavor of what I heard now that I had that kind of background.
Yes.
So I think a lot of people might... be a little confused as to exactly what the motivations are in the video, given that we're talking about someone who, if you're an agnostic now, or even a hardcore atheist, I mean, it used the phrase baby eater, which, sorry, I don't know how anybody could ever use that terminology at all, but I guess it's sort of something atheists do. Why raise these elements of critique?
Right. Yeah, that's the question, is when the video was posted on our page initially, didn't know who he was.
It wasn't
that long ago. Maybe it was about a month and a half ago or so, but the video was posted. When people had seen it and just let me know, hey, this video, you should take a look at it, not only was I confused when I first listened to it, because he says, I'm concerned because you're going to take people away from the gospel and the kingdom of God, and I was like, well, okay, this is just a believer who's trying to offer a critique, and then it just sort of kind of devolved, and I started looking things up, and I got the idea that maybe he was an atheist now. He's definitely abandoned the faith, and he's either an atheist or an agnostic. Again, in one of his videos, he refers to him and others in the room, I suppose, are atheists as baby eaters, as you know, in jest. But other people had, you know, said, hey, I'm confused. Where's this guy at? What is he? And I did see your interaction with him on the YouTube video, and I don't usually have anything to do with YouTube comments. It's just a world I don't want to go into.
Yeah.
A world I wish didn't really exist. but he did say back to you that, you know, in reference to, you know, maybe my exegesis was wrong, but I still think it's, you know, it's not a good, you know, apologetic. And he says that, you know, it's the same critique that an atheist could offer you or a Muslim. My response to that is not true.
No.
Muslims come from a different perspective that revelation is actually possible, and that so it is a different perspective. No, they can't offer the same critiques as an atheist. And here's the thing I would want to say to Noah, if he were to listen and he was really, you know, saying, okay, you know, why are you challenged by my statements? I would say, okay, Noah, what if in our response today, if you wanted to offer a critique, if we were to say to you, well, Noah, over the last couple of days, last 7 days, a lot of things can happen in 7 days. We've had some significant changes to our position, but none of those changes are relevant in your future critiques of me. They don't matter because my critique of you as an atheist is just my critique of you as an atheist, and my beliefs are really irrelevant to the discussion, so don't bring them up. I think anybody would see, well, that's not really true. It's not really honest. It's not genuine. Of course your beliefs are relevant to your critique of me. And so,
well, but of course, from his perspective, we're so lazy that our apologetic ignores all the differences between atheists.
Yeah.
When in reality, what we're saying is there is a fundamental spiritual reality that is true of all human beings that will manifest itself in many different ways.
Yep.
But if you ignore that fundamental reality, you will never actually get to the true source of what the problem is in the first place.
Right. That's right.
That's what he seems to have been missing. And that's what a lot of evidentialist apologists seem to miss. And part of that's because some of the critiques of presuppositionalism out there, even from Reformed folks, are not all that accurate or show a real understanding of what it is we're attempting to say.
Yeah.
Look, before I start the video, here's the point. From my perspective, here's why am I a presuppositionalist? Well, it's real simple. First of all, I believe that apologetics flows from your theology.
Yes.
If you develop an apologetic methodology and then tweak your theology to fit your apologetics, you've got it backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I see a lot of people that do that. And there needs to be a natural, consistent flow from what you positively believe about, first of all, who God is. It has to be a God-centered theology. If you've got a man-centered theology, good luck. There's no coherent means of coming up with a consistent system at that point. But a God-centered theology with a biblical anthropology, you don't have those two things in place, you're not going to be able to create a truly Christ-honoring, consistent apologetic methodology at that
That's
point.
Right.
And that's really where it all comes from for me. And that's why I was shocked at so much of what Noah said at the beginning, because I'm assuming the guy's a Christian. Listened to it the second time, and I'm not sure why he was raising the issues that he was. So
yeah.
Let's dive into it, or we're never going to get this done. This is going to be a jumbo mega mondo. Run straight through it tomorrow? It's 44 minutes long, so no, I'm not going to run it straight through. So, no, we're going to be starting and stopping. No two ways about it. Now, there are three texts that he focuses upon. After we get through the introduction stuff, there are three texts. 1 Peter 3:15, mm-hmm. Romans chapter 1, and Colossians chapter 2. And I told Noah, and with all due respect, on an exegetical level, he face-planted all three of them. Did not seem to recognize background. I don't. Again, it would be nice to know. Did he have any seminary training? Does he know any of the biblical languages? Is there anything there? I can't tell.
Yeah.
You can't tell from a video like this. But I think it's very important to respond. Those are key texts. At least he went to the right text.
Mm-hmm.
Just did not handle them well at all. Let's dive in, and here we go.
There. I'm making this video response to Jeff Durbin and everyone at Apologia Studios. And in case you're wondering who the heck I am, my name is Noah. I was an evidential apologist for about 10 years. I maintained a fairly successful YouTube channel back when YouTube was actually about interaction between users. I went by the username Veritas48 because truth 48 sounded cool. I really don't know why I chose that. No, but in all seriousness, I was actually kind of a big deal back in the day. I was. Anyway, that was a long time.
No, I like that. That's obviously created.
Yeah.
Specifically to, you know, it almost looked like he was looking off into the distance and experiencing it. You know, and now of course, in knowing what's happened since then, has different meaning that I initially would have. But again, I don't remember Veritas 48, and sadly, Veritas is not the most uncommon name that people choose.
Yeah.
Like, there are even seminaries. That.
That's right.
And a lot has changed since then. When you're an evidential apologist, you sort of find yourself pushed into a certain niche, whether it's cult apologetics or scientific apologetics, or in my case, philosophical apologetics. I really enjoyed natural theology and arguing for the existence of God.
It tells you something.
It does.
It tells you something. Natural theology to a Reformed person, you know, fundamental to our critique of much of evidentialism is the idea that God's creation can be appropriately interpreted apart from his special revelation.
Yes.
Which begins all the way back with Adam.
Mm-hmm.
There is such thing as natural revelation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the scope of what it communicates is extremely limited.
Mm-hmm.
And it also doesn't deal with the issue of sin and the fallenness.
The noetic
of
the
noetic effects
of sin.
Effects of sin,
the effect
things.
Of sin on our minds.
Exactly, yes. Which is what we'll get into in Romans 1.
Yep.
My mission field, completely by accident, sort of happened to be secular folk. Atheists. One of the main reasons that I like this area of apologetics was that it allowed me to bridge gaps between my faith and unbelievers. It was kind of like building a bridge in which me, the evidential apologist, would sort of meet the atheist halfway so that...
Okay, so... And by the way, if you just want me to just go... And I'll...
Yeah, you got
we'll
it.
Stop that. Meet the atheist halfway. Build a bridge. Go mm-hmm. out there in that neutral ground in the middle.
Well, okay, let me just say this. When I talk to atheists, I try to build a bridge in a way... But it's a different kind of approach. Uh-huh. It's trying to establish common ground that is God's ground.
Which is what?
All of creation belongs to God. And they know the God. They're in his image. The God that I'm talking about. Now, again, the argument is not, you know God. Yes, you do. No, you don't. Yes, you
right.
do. It's not
right.
that. It's that I do try to establish common ground with an image bearer of God.
That's the only biblical point of contact.
Yes.
Is that this is my fellow creature. We're both made in the image of God. This idea... See, this is, and we're going to get into this in Colossians, but if you really believe, for by him were all things made, whether in heaven or earth, visible or invisible, principalities, powers, dominions, or authorities, all things created by him and for him. He is before all things, and him all things synesteken, they hold together.
Yes.
That means there is nothing Jesus didn't create.
Sounds like a metaphysical statement.
It sounds as cosmological and extensive and expansive as it could possibly be.
Sounds like you're doing philosophy, right?
Oh, boy, yeah. you're doing theology that determines anything beneath it.
That's right.
Is under its umbrella.
That's right.
And if you believe that, then if I say to the unbeliever, I'm going to lay my presuppositions aside, you lay yours aside, let's stand on this neutral ground. And then, let's say I'm successful. Let's say I begin to incrementally move them along my argument. Somewhere down the road, I'm going to have to tell them about what Colossians 1 says about Jesus.
Yep.
And if they're as sharp as I am, there you go. Well, wait a minute. Jesus created everything? God's the creator of all things? Back at the start, you told me that we could sort of stand on neutral ground together.
Yeah.
But now you're telling me there is no such thing as neutral ground. Every fact that is a fact was made a fact by Jesus.
That's right. Every fact is a fact of God.
And you just have to go,
yeah, gotcha.
Gotcha.
So,
gotcha.
So here's the thing. Hey, this is important. Who is being the most honest and having integrity in terms of flowing through the discussion, saying, let's put it on the table? I believe without any kind of a criticism and attack on brothers who aren't here and are maybe evidentialists in their thinking, I think the person that's presuppositional in their approach to apologetics is the one that's saying, I want to be the most consistent and the most honoring to Christ, and I want to make sure that I have integrity in the discussion with the unbeliever, because I'm not pretending neutrality. He's not neutral, I'm not neutral.
Well, and you're defining consistency by saying most consistent with God's revelation.
With God's revelation.
I mean, God's revelation. But see, a lot of folks don't believe that the Bible actually defines the realm of appropriate apologetic interaction.
Yeah.
Just like they don't believe the Bible defines the realm of appropriate worship.
Yeah.
So if you don't accept that the Bible actually provides those parameters, then that's one reason why people go that direction. But if you are convinced that sola scriptura means something more than you only have to carry 66 little books around, then, yeah, you have to go a different direction. No trays about it.
Both reason together about the world and our place in it, things like meaning and morality, you know, just small things like that, little tiny things like that. And so, Jeff, if you watch this video, just know that that's my background. If I come off snarky or rude, I don't purposefully mean for that to overshadow my criticisms. But there will be snark. There will be. So why am I making this video? I'm making this video because I sincerely believe that your approach to apologetics ends up damaging your ultimate message.
I forgot to play that thing that I spent all that time putting together.
What?
The whole long list of all his snarky comments. I apologize, folks. We spent so much time talking about the basic things. There's a lot of utilization of terms like absurd,
yep,
lazy, dangerous, a lot of pretty strong terminology. And when you put them all together, you're like, whoa. And I actually put together a sound file of about the first 20, 25 minutes. I just collected all the, this is egregiously absurd, ridiculous, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you put it all together for about 4 minutes worth of stuff. And I was going to start off the program with that and totally space it. I'm not sure if it's just the joy that is exuding from our colors.
It makes it difficult to think clearly.
Hey, man. You know, by the way, Rich Pierce is manning the controls today, making all of this possible.
Barely.
Fighting with the cameras to keep them functioning because they're overheating. But I brought a Coogee sweater for Brother Rich to wear today. You saw it, right?
I did.
And I just want everybody to know, I did not want to leave him out. I wanted to offer him the opportunity of entering into the spirit of the season, the spirit of the program.
It's magical.
Like that.
I am wearing plaid. It's fine.
No. And he is from Prescott.
Yes.
Okay. And I can guarantee you one thing about Prescott. The only Coogees in Prescott were imported to Prescott by people who did not grow up in Prescott.
Yes.
Would that be a fair statement? What?
The only coogies in Prescott are what things look like after you've gone hunting. You're welcome.
A lot of blood, a lot of color, a lot of just.
I'm sorry. That's beneath comment. That's beneath comment. All right, we move along. That's a brief break there because of the heavy lifting.
Lifting. Just one thing to say about the criticisms in terms of, you know, like egregious and this is bad and this is awful. Here, look, this needs to be understood. Look, when you make claims like that, this is bad, this is awful, this is fallacious, you know, this is all. Here's the thing: you're making assumptions behind those things that you can't just have as a given. Because you see, if I sit down with a professor of biological evolution at a university that tells me, oh, there is no imminent morality, you know, we all live, we die, and we're gone, we're absolutely gone, we die, you know, there's no imminent morality, no ultimate oughts, I don't get to sit down in front of that guy and just start whipping things out saying, oh, that's just absolutely wrong and evil and you can't treat people that way, because from his perspective, that's not even possible in his universe. Right. So when someone says to me, you know, this is bad, this is awful, I want to ask, well, by what standard is that bad? How do you judge whether something is off logically? Do I have to have integrity in debating you? Like, for example, do I have any obligation to treat Noah with respect, with dignity, with honor? Do I have any obligation, moral obligation, to have integrity in my response to him? Could I make a YouTube video absolutely lying about what Noah claimed? Could I make up quotes from Noah that he absolutely did not say? Could I make a video like that? Am I obligated morally not to do that? You see, the point is that when you make these sort of claims against really anybody, certain things have to be true about the world for those to have any meaning whatsoever. And his abandonment of Christ, I would argue, he's given up any meaning in those statements. Mm. When you say something is illogical, when you say it's not true, when you say that it's bad for people, when you say it's destructive, I want to say when you give up Jesus, you give up all those things.
Well, he's going to say later on that logic isn't something we have to explain. It's just what makes things the way they are.
It's just the way that it is.
And didn't seem to understand your brute facts thing, but well, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Is that in the later part? I don't remember.
Not sure.
But yeah, the brute facts one I was going, did not understand the brute facts thing at all.
No.
At all. But we continue on, or we're never, ever going to even get close to getting this.
We'll be here
at
midnight.
I hope you'll hear me out. You have this new giant platform at Apologia Studios, and clearly you're being supported financially because of your apologetic endeavors. And so with this new platform, I think it's important to challenge you about your apologetic approach and your arguments. So let's have a conversation. You've had James White on recently. You've had quite a few Christians on. But look, James White already agrees with you, right? Let's try and have a conversation with someone who disagrees with you. I'd like to see more of that from your ministry. And so that's what I'm...
But that almost makes it sound like he's a Christian there, giving another perspective.
It does. And for the record, you approached me about doing this video.
You had actually, a couple weeks ago, said, hey, let's do something. And then I'm just looking at December going, oh, this is insane.
Yeah.
And we weren't able to do something, and I hadn't even seen it.
Yeah, that's right. So you approach me with this. You know, I think it's just important for us to, as we have so much to do in this video, you know, when it comes to people that agree with me, let me just address that real fast. You know, our ministry, we have had Dan Barker, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, on the radio program. I try to go for the big shots. I got Dan Barker on the show.
No, I'd be a brave man because he has more attorneys on retainer than anybody else in the
world. Yeah, and so we've traveled and went to the Reason Rally and put content up from the Reason Rally to try to engage atheists. And I went I went searching at the Reason Rally with these 30,000 atheists and unbelievers for somebody that was very, very rigorous in their thinking, and I found the co-president of the Atheist Society at Cornell, because he was sophisticated and he knew his stuff and he knew the language. I said, I got to have you for this. I want somebody that can really represent atheistic thought in a good way. We've had atheists on our show. We've had I think he's the president of the Atheist Society at ASU at this point. We've had him on the show. I've done two public debates with atheists, and so I, you know, when it comes to having people on that disagree with you, you know, we've done that. We try to do that. We try to make sure we give atheists a fair shake.
Yeah. Well, and now we're giving him a fair shake by letting him have his say, too.
That's
so right. Let's press on.
Try and present you with here. See, that's what I meant about snark right there. That was snark. So I'll start the video off this way. I can't conceive of how an intelligent, educated person could listen to what you have to say about your religious epistemology and think that it's true. I just can't. It's so demonstrably false, as I'll attempt to show in this video, that it makes me feel like we've actually started to hear the noise of the gravediggers who are burying God. Like, I could actually hear them whistling as they pour dirt on God while I watch your videos.
Very creative.
Well, very creative.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly sure what it means.
No.
But it sounds like you're doing, like you're bad.
Yeah. There's a difference between being able to make very colorful statements that sound very erudite and well thought out and actually backing up those claims. When it comes to epistemology, intelligent, educated, you know, in presuppositional apologetics, if Noah would do any study, I would highly recommend for him, if he really wants to know, picking up Van Til's Apologetic by Greg Bahnsen. It's just sort of a collection of different things from Van Til and sort of distilling his thought. Bahnsen kind of just brings out this is what he was saying. One of the things you'll note when you begin to study Van Til is that he was very, very particular about making sure that our epistemology was coherent. That's where it was all at, the area of how do we know what we know. And Van Til used to talk about people in terms of their epistemological loafers. They're lazy. And he didn't just mean that about unbelievers. He meant that about Christians and Christian apologists. They're loafers. They're lazy. They haven't even thought through their worldview enough to say, why do I believe what I believe? And how do I know this is true? And what works? So when it comes to the area of epistemology, that is an area that you will find, I think, some of the greatest work from presuppositionalists in terms of this is why we believe what we believe, and we've thought through that. And in my experience, just out of respect, I haven't found that to be as rigorous a commitment in terms of thinking it through in the area of evidentialist apologetics. I'm not saying there aren't people that do that. I'm saying that it seems to me, in my experience, that you find that the most in the area of presuppositional apologetics. We want to know why. And how we know what we know.
Okay.
It is. And I'm going to try to convince you that this is the case, or at least put a rock in your shoe about the whole thing. So my goal here is to kind of give a critique about a couple of things. First, how you approach non-believers through your exegesis of Scripture. And then secondly, the actual arguments that you use to defend your faith against secular people. I'm going to attempt to show you that the views that you teach others, and indeed your entire religious epistemology, is first and foremost almost certainly false. But it's
almost certainly?
Almost certainly.
That two things caught me right there. One was I had heard the almost certainly false.
Okay.
Because I've listened to this twice. It's the first time I'm watching it. That thumb is going to drive me insane.
The thumb?
Someone mentioned on Twitter that he's gesturing with his hands, but all you can see is the thumb going like this. It's going to drive me absolutely... You think a coochie's bad? I love my coochie. I think a coochie's beautiful. But having a thumb doing the need, you know, put some eyes and a nose on it or something like that. Add to the stuff here. But yeah, just watch.
So myopic and dangerous. And that doesn't mean that Christianity is false, myopic, or dangerous. It just means that Vantillian presuppositionalism has created a kind of monster. And it's a monster that I'm going to argue actually moves people away from the gospel message. And I'm hopeful that since your ministry is called Apologia Studios, that you'll at least watch this video with a sort of 1 Peter 3:15-ish kind of demeanor. So you...
I have to.
How did he get the right pronunciation, though?
Yeah, he... I thought it was the same thing.
You did, right?
Maybe he has had some Greek.
Yeah, a little Greek. Go. Apologia. Good job, Noah. You're making Dr. White very happy.
But that aside, why is an agnostic saying that your apologetic is going to move people away from the faith?
Yeah.
That's what I could not...
Yeah. That's the I have to say, with respect to Noah, that is the bit of deception. And I believe in the video, I'm not trying to say anything about his motives. I'm saying it is deceptive in nature to make the video in this way. Because I would have to work very hard at making a video for atheists, critiquing, saying, all right, now, atheists, listen, we got to get this right, guys. We just got to start doing this right.
Exactly.
Because we're going to look foolish to Christians. You know, you would say, wait a second, Jeff, you're not being completely honest in that critique. That's what I would call Noah too. It's just a little more honesty in terms of where he's coming from and what his motivations are. But one thing I want to point out before you go to the next part He says, I hope you watch this with a 1 Peter 3:15 kind of mentality. Gentleness, respect, having an apologia.
Which, you know, yeah, which he's going to criticize you for later.
I want to say, I'm a sinner, and I may fail in a lot of ways, but there's a standard like that exists outside of me that I have to hold up and be submitted to. And so if I ever fail as a Christian, I'm going to ask for forgiveness for those failings. I want to do better because I want to bring glory to my Savior. But you'll notice something in this discussion. I hope everybody sees this. When Noah makes this critique and he says, Jeff, I hope you approach this in a 1 Peter 3:15 kind of way, I want to say, I do have to hold to that standard. But guess what, Noah? You don't. You don't have to hold to a standard really at all at this point because you've abandoned Christ. And notice what has to happen. The unbeliever can say to the Christian, you need to show gentleness, you need to show respect, but not Noah.
Yeah,
I actually have to hold to those commitments because I'm a Christian. Gentleness, respect, having a reasoned defense for the faith, for the hope that's within me. But the unbeliever doesn't have to do that.
Oh, but he would say that he still holds those things.
Sure, but without any coherent foundation, without any real ought behind it.
Ought rather than yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Particular apologetic approach that you believe is justified by certain passages in Scripture. And these passages lead you to interact with people in a particular way. They form the basis of how you interact with those outside of the faith. The way you interpret these verses leads you to believe the following. First, that there can be no such thing as knowledge apart from Christ. That Christ is the epistemological foundation of all knowledge. Secondly, that all men really know that God exists and they're just suppressing it. And third, you believe that the preferred...
Now, real quickly, really know that God exists, but they're just suppressing it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, what we understand katakanton to mean in Romans 1:18 can take many different forms and does not require a conscious, I know that Yahweh exists, and I am going to suppress that by atheism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Scientism, drugs, sex, rock and roll, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be stuck on this idea that what we're actually saying is that everyone has a clearly formed conception, basically based upon revelation, as if they've all read the Bible, they know Yahweh exists, and that suppression is that purposeful, so they're all just a bunch of liars, rather than what we're saying, and that is, you're creating the image of God, there are certain things that natural revelation reveals to you, you're supposed to give thanks to God and honor Him as God, but you refuse to do that, and there has been this exchange.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Romans 1:18 language of the exchange of the truth for a lie. And that lie can be, that lie is multifaceted.
Yes.
As man's experience demonstrates.
That's
we'll
right.
have to deal with Romans 1 here in a few minutes when he says that it has nothing to do with atheists, but it actually has to do with all humanity. But it seems that the idea is, well, what you all are saying is that people have this absolute clarity that Yahweh is the one true God, and they're just simply suppressing that. And they simplify it down rather than, again, you know, I have to deal with apologetics with Muslims. I'm dealing with people who are theists. They believe in one God, the creator of all things.
Yeah.
And yet there is still an element, fundamental element of suppression.
Yeah.
In dealing with that, especially when it comes to their denial of original sin and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
You can simplify it for the sake of trying to make an argument, but we're not the ones doing the simplification.
Yeah, the point is self-deception.
Oh, yeah.
We're self-deceived. Our sin has corrupted our reasoning faculties, and Romans 1 is not simply, like you said, about just atheists. We're not saying, there's the atheist text. That's the humanity text. That's our experience.
As we will see.
Yeah, and that's what we go off into all kinds of different religions, and we pursue all kinds of different gods, and unbelievers have a way that Romans 1 works out in their life. But it's not the whole thing.
Right. Definitely.
Apologetic method ought to be to assume God's existence and Christ's triumph and show that the atheist lives in a kind of absurd way without believing in Christianity. They sort of pop their head into Francis Schaeffer's upper story. And so these verses that we're going to be talking about will sort of form the basis for those dangerous and almost certainly false beliefs.
Oh.
In your video entitled Street Level Apologetics, you point out that 1 Peter 3:15 begins with the words, but in your heart sanctify Christ as Lord. And it then continues with the famous piece that everyone remembers, and always be prepared to articulate a defense to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have with gentleness and respect. Now to you, the early part of this verse means something particular. That part at the beginning about sanctifying Christ as Lord will in essence dictate the sort of apologetic approach that you feel is biblical. And what I want to argue is that it's ultimately that apologetic approach that turns people away from the gospel. It sullies your message in a way that I hope matters to you. And this is sort of a...
Now, I just have to stop. I want to let him do his whole 1 Peter 3 thing, then we'll take it apart exegetically. But, sadly, there is a consistency here on his part of the evidential apologist, mm-hmm. which again... Sullies. These are not. This is not language of an agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is not. I've never had an agnostic come up to me and say you're sullied. You know, that then assumes a standard that they don't actually believe exists in the first place. But it's very pragmatic, very very pragmatic. Clearly, once again, if you believe God is accomplishing His will in this world, if you believe He has an elect people, if you believe that the Spirit of God is the only one that can take out a heart of stone, give a heart of flesh. Raise people to spiritual life. This type of pragmatic theology has no place. So it would seem to me that if this reflects at least the theology that he once held but no longer holds, because I can't place it anyplace else. There's no connection to an agnostic here.
Right.
Then you would have a very sub-biblical theology, which he evidently, though not holding to it anymore, is still in some way connected to.
He can't quite shake his Christianity.
Can't quite get rid of it, I guess, yeah.
No, but I find it interesting that the emphasis you choose to place on this verse is the part about sanctification and not the part about having a demeanor of gentleness and respect when defending your faith. And this will clearly be reflected in many of your street apologetics videos, where you interact with people extemporaneously, like the one that you have that mocks transgendered people by comparing them to a man in a dog outfit who sincerely believes that he's a dog. That lack of empathy and inability to grasp the gravitas of that issue for a lot of people is a sign that you really do focus on the first part of that verse and not the latter. But
I'd like to address that. One of the things I think you'll note in my fallible approach to trying to reach people with the gospel is I do want to try to demonstrate a level of respect and love, and I'll even tell people as I talk to them who are atheists that say we're just stardust, I'll say I don't accept that about you. You're not that low as just stardust. So I want to try to be consistent with my commitments to say, no, I see you as greater, as better, as having more meaning, more dignity, more value than you give yourself.
Right.
Now, I know I have failings as a sinner before God, and again, if I ever have failings, I want to make sure I confess those, and I want to grow even as a believer. But in terms of his example of the transgender video, you and I were talking about this over lunch.
Right.
It's interesting, when the whole issue with Bruce Jenner came up and also with Rachel Dolezal came up, you have two incidents that came up very close in proximity towards one another. One is a man who mutilated his body, a grandfather who mutilated his body and pretended to be a woman, and everyone's saying, well, that's a woman. Another one was a white woman who was pretending to be a black woman. And so we want to answer the fool according to their folly. And so the question was in the video, approaching the culture in a way to say, okay, now let's be consistent now. If a man, if a grandfather can mutilate his body and dress like a woman, does it make him a woman? Well, sure. How about if a woman who's white says that she's black? She black? Well, no. How about if a man dresses like a dog? Is he a dog? He'll say, oh, that's ridiculous. You're not Puddles. You're not Puddles. You're not a dog. You're a man. What's interesting here is almost a moment, James, that was prophetic in that video. Was we threw out a wild example in that video while we were on the street. I said, ask people if I was a 50-year-old man, could I, and I wanted to be, I thought I was a 6-year-old little girl, mm-hmm. could I do that? I said, let's make it as crazy as possible. Right. We got a dog, let's do that. As soon as he asked the question, people are like, no, not a 6-year-old girl. And the amazing thing is that as this video comes out with Noah challenging us on the video, that very thing is in our news feed right now.
Constant.
So
it's far
from being a mean-spirited attack upon that worldview. That's the very thing we're seeing in front of us today.
And we got mentioned there is, if you haven't seen it, it's all over Facebook. But there is a video, and it's a serious, not this isn't made up. This guy has been applauded by the LGBT, especially the T part of that community. And he has seven kids in his 50s.
Yeah.
And he dresses like a little girl and pretends to be a six-year-old little girl.
Pacifier.
With a pacifier.
With a pacifier.
A six-year-old.
He's been adopted by an older couple that lets him live with them as a six-year-old little girl.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get that far.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
So when Noah says, you know, you're demeaning to them, you're not really understanding their experience in a way.
You're not empathetic.
As a matter of fact, we are just showing the results of the worldview. Now, somebody might say, well, that's offensive. But the point is there are people who really live like that. For example, there are people who believe that they're animals, that have actually mutilated their body to look like cats, to look like parrots. There are people who mutilate their bodies to look like women, people who try to look like a black woman when they're white, and there are people who try to live like little six-year-old girls. That's not demeaning. That's me asking a real question.
Well, and not only that, let me just point out, when people say, well, that's offensive, well, sometimes love is offensive.
Yeah.
It is not loving to not challenge that kind of absolute rejection of the reality in which we live.
Yeah.
Anybody who is supporting that man in dishonoring himself, in dishonoring his family, in dishonoring his children, in dishonoring motherhood, fatherhood, everything else, anyone who supports him in that is not showing God love, is not showing themselves love, and is not showing him love.
That's right.
We have to recapture the meaning of the term love, because our society has come up with a squishy emotion rather than the biblical definition of love.
Yeah.
There was a day when people recognized that if you loved your family, then as a man, you would sacrifice yourself to protect your family. And so they would defend us against people like Hitler and so on and so forth, and they died in D-Day. The greatest evil you can do is to offend someone, to hurt someone's feelings.
Yeah.
It's immaturity. It's not love.
That's right.
And we need to start saying that is not love.
Yeah.
That is sentimentality. They're not the same thing.
That's important. And just briefly, I'll say in Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5, it tells believers how to reason with people. One is don't answer the fool according to their folly. And the second is to answer the fool according to their folly, lest they be wise in their own conceit. So I hope Noah can listen to this perspective. The video that we put out that he's critiquing there, we're addressing that issue, was answering the fool according to their folly.
Right.
I want to approach the world on their terms and say, is this true? Because that's what you believe. You want to live consistently with this? Now, again, the way that we view love, like you said today, is an emotional thing, not as something that needs to confront. And I think as Christians, we need to look at the Bible and see there are times when God's prophets and God's spokesmen and God's people speak to people with a serrated edge.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes it's necessary if you love people to yell at them before they jump off the cliff.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And we now live in a day where to say anything about truth is to risk offense.
Yeah.
And anyway, we haven't gotten to the first verse yet. Well, we're sort of working our way through it here.
Yeah.
I digress. To you, that part of this verse is interpreted to mean that Jesus is Lord over all of your reasoning, that he ought to be the foundation for all knowledge, that his lordship is an axiomatic component of a Christian's epistemology. And thus we begin to see the blossoming of your presuppositionalism. And because of this, you say in your video, quote, I don't approach apologetics with neutrality. I'm not approaching the defense of the gospel with a maybe Jesus is who he claimed to be. Let's reason and see if we can get there. How very Vantillian of you.
Amen.
You use the example of Paul going into the synagogues and discussing Christ with the Jews. And you say, look, you know, he reasoned from the scripture. The scriptures were his foundation. And you sort of extrapolate from this a kind of normative approach to apologetics. in which this ought to be the standard for all of apologetics. But of course, Jews believe in God, right? Or at least the ones Paul was reasoning with certainly did. In fact, most everyone Paul likely interacted with was a theist of some kind. Atheism was exceedingly rare in those days, especially in that part of the world. So it makes sense to start with the existence of God already in the bag when reasoning with people like this. Additionally, relying on scripture as the foundation of your apologetic is obviously appropriate for audiences who already believe in those scriptures. But if Paul was talking to someone who, let's say, felt the scriptures were unreliable documents for some reason or another, or perhaps didn't believe in God at all, or perhaps had no conception of God, can you see how starting with God or reasoning from the scriptures isn't going to work for that sort of person?
Just really quickly, isn't going to work for that sort of person.
Theology matters.
Well, theology matters, and here revelation matters as to the nature of man himself.
Yeah.
There is a specific point where he transitions from 1 Peter to the next one.
Yeah.
I almost feel like getting all of that in and then going back over this, but there's so many things in between that's sort of like, oh.
Well, let me just say, just quickly, when he says Paul approaches the Jews in Acts chapter 9, reasoning from the scriptures, because they already believe in the scriptures, well, I'm going to say this. You need to also look at Paul everywhere else he evangelizes. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Acts chapter 17 at the Areopagus. Right. I want to say, read Acts 17 with Romans 1 right next to it.
Right.
You'll see that he's reasoning from his fundamental commitments in Acts 17 as he is in Acts chapter 9. Right. There's no difference. He's not switching epistemological standards from one to the next. And relying on Scripture for people who agree with it versus those who don't agree with it, I want to say that's inconsistent to say that the standard itself changes in its claims to authority based on who you speak to.
Right.
So if I talk to the person over here that accepts the Word of God, it's true because they accept it. But if I go over here, it's no longer the final authority if they don't accept it. Right. It's one of the things that Bonson pointed out. You know, people want to say, and let's build a ladder with different rungs on it, and let's get to all these different points of evidence and science and logic and reason. And good, we make our way all the way up there. The evidentialist says we get to God. We're there now. And we get there and we realize, well, he had all the authority the whole time. We didn't really need the ladder. You know, and that's the point, is if God is the ultimate authority, if he's the final resting place, then his authority is final whether somebody accepts it or not. And it doesn't mean that I just make the claim of his authority. Of course, God makes the claim, but it can be demonstrated that he is in fact authoritative, and they know the God that we're talking about, and all these appeals that he's making really are now incoherent without him.
Mm-hmm. Well, one-size-fits-all apologetics is quite simply going to lead to more atheists. People's spiritual development comes in all different types of colorations.
Spiritual development? Even as a Christian,
yeah.
What would that have meant to him as an evidentialist?
Yeah.
Does he not believe man's dead in sin?
Yeah.
And now as an agnostic, what in the world is that?
Yeah.
I have no earthly idea.
Yeah.
That's what left me so
confused.
Confused.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I had to honestly ask the question. Anyway.
Yeah.
Gospel message may sit well with a monotheist struggling with who God really is, but it's apt to fail if one has sincere intellectual reservations about the concept of God being coherent.
What does it mean to fail? Evidently, failure is not getting the person to do what you want them to do. That's a completely different definition than any... I mean, God's word never fails.
That's right.
It always accomplishes what he intended it to accomplish. Theology matters again. Yeah.
But you have an answer to this. You have an ace up your sleeve that we'll get into in a minute. Right. Namely, right. You believe that all people really do believe in God, no matter what they say. So going back to this, but in your heart sanctify Christ as Lord, why should anybody think that this verse is advocating anything other than simply keeping Christ sacrosanct? To get from, but in your heart, sanctify Christ as Lord, to I don't approach apologetics with neutrality, is a gap so large that if we took every stupid thing Ray Comfort has ever said and we turned each one of them into a football field and stretched them out end to end, it would equate to roughly one-fifth of the gap between those two statements. Honest to God.
Honest to who?
Honest to who? Can't shake your Christianity, Noah. He might just say, well, that Jeff, that's James, that's an expression. Well, the thing about expressions is that they become expressions for a reason.
Yeah.
Because, and it's just one of those things, honest to God?
Yeah.
That's
but,
just a strange
but,
thing.
But
to
even
say.
That, even that. Okay. I want to address this phrase, but I want to see if he's let's see if he's ready to move to the next one, and then we can do it all at one shot.
Reading things into the verse. I agree with you that this verse is implying a connection between apologetics and evangelism, but evangelism comes in many forms. Sometimes it's simply removing barriers to belief. And that's what the evidentialist apologist has on you. And this is why presuppositional apologetics is horrifically ineffective in bringing people to the gospel. It just is. And I'm usually pretty careful of making, you know, giant sweeping generalizations like that. But I'm just going to flat out say it. It's this kind of apologetic that does not bring people into the kingdom of God. Now,
I thought the Spirit of God brought people into the kingdom of God.
Yep.
And I thought he used means and... I thought this was a discussion of what is consistent with God's revelation. This is all pragmatic, experiential, observational. Oh, I think this does that. Theology matters, and we've got someone here who evidently in their Christian days had a really bad theology.
Yes.
Really low view of God's sovereignty and a very high view of man's capacity as a sinner, evidently.
Yeah, and there's a giant concern at this point for this is really going to drive people away from Jesus.
Yeah,
my friend, and that's just confusing to me. Once again, we've talked about it a bunch now, but it's just confusing to me. And I think we have so much more to do here. But again, I agree with you. Driving people away, it's our sin that keeps us from God. And I don't throw out arguments that. That's the thing that sends them away from God. They go, okay, now I'm going to rebel against God because that argument was so bad.
Exactly.
The issue is much deeper than that. It goes back far longer than that. And it's foundationally our sin that keeps us from... Jesus says in John chapter 8, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. We're slaves. We're not free. And the Bible says in Romans 1 that all humanity knows God, suppresses the truth of God. He's so clearly known because of God's own creation that we become futile in our thinking. Our foolish hearts are darkened. We profess to be wise.
That was just one.
Right. That's what the text says. Yeah.
Yeah. But interestingly, you quoted John 8, and what was the reaction of the Jews when Jesus said, slave to sin?
We haven't been a slave to anybody.
Offense.
Yeah.
Absolute offense
is
taken immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to go to the point where he switches to the next one, and then we'll wrap it up.
Real fast. If you would like to meet anybody that's come to Christ on the basis of an argument from Scripture with the gospel, I can introduce them to some ex-atheists at Apologia Church that have come to Jesus. So if you'd like to meet them.
Oh, well, definitely.
Okay.
One person, and my experience is limited, but I'm not aware of anyone in my entire apologetic career who has ever made it into the faith for...
Now, again, my entire apologetic career, which ended exactly when?
Yeah. He's speaking as though it were current.
Yeah, speaks as if don't tell me that's not purposeful. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I can't buy it.
Mm-hmm. I have a path created by presuppositional apologetics, but what do I know? I'm simply convinced that you're confusing the way in which two people reason together in a conversation in order to come to a conclusion with removing pieces of your commitment to that belief you're defending when you have that conversation. You've simply assumed that approaching a disagreement on neutral grounds means that you've devalued the thing you sincerely believe and are defending.
Not devalued, denied.
Yes.
It's an entire worldview that flows from the amazing, outstanding, from the world's perspective, moronic assertion that the creator of this universe actually entered into his own universe in the person of Jesus Christ. That is an amazing thing. And according to the scriptures, a foolish thing to the world.
That's right.
It's not a matter of devaluing it. It's you have to live in light of it, or down the road you're going to have to admit, yeah, I was lying to you. Yep, you're right. There are certain absolute results of believing that I completely lied to you about. I skipped them. I said I could set them aside, and the reality is you can't set any of them aside.
That's right. And Noah admits here that in 1 Peter 3:15, he says, now I'll grant there is a connection between Christ's lordship and evangelism in this text. I'm sorry, Noah. The text says apologia.
Yes, yes.
That's the reason defense. Okay,
that's what it is,
and so it's not. But I agree. By the way, I agree that there is a connection between lordship and evangelism. But But that's not all that's happening in the text. Now, if you grant, Noah, if you grant that there is a connection based upon this text, then you've given it up. That you've given up the argument. There is a connection between the lordship of Christ and what takes place in evangelism here. But the text itself talks about apologia, a reasoned defense. And that word goes beyond simple discussions about evangelism. It has to do with a defense of our faith, providing a reasoned defense of our faith. And I don't know if you want to talk about this now, the exegesis.
Let's make sure we got everything he's done, got on it, so we don't have to redo it.
But that's crazy. I mean, if you really think about it, it actually kind of shows how committed you are to your beliefs. Right? You're willing to take a step back and say, all right, I know that I believe this thing very strongly. In fact, I would claim to know it. But this other person doesn't. And I want to better understand this person's reservation so that I can remove whatever intellectual barriers are holding them back from the belief I want them to hold.
Intellectual barriers. I am not denying that people have intellectual barriers. What I am denying is the Bible says the intellect is separate from the spirit. And that the noose, the mind, has not been darkened by the effect of sin.
Yeah.
That's really, again, no evidence of a truly biblical anthropology.
Yes.
In what is being said, though it's being expressed in the context of some type of religious something, which I don't really...
And it would be good to note, too, that one of the things Van Til is famous for saying is that we invite the unbeliever onto our system to do an internal critique.
Right.
Van Til invites the world, you step into our system, do an internal critique of our system.
And we'll do an internal critique of yours,
that's
too.
That's right, that's right.
But not by pretending that we're neutral
that's
in this
right.
in,
that's
at all.
Shows that you take the conversation and the person that you're interacting with seriously. You know, everyone has things they sincerely believe, not just you, Jeff, not just Christians. Everyone has views or even entire canons that they believe are true or sacred. And it's the mark of an intellectually honest person to be able to temporarily strip themselves of whatever sincerely held assumptions they have for the purposes of discourse.
No, hold on a second. So we're not intellectually honest or rigorous or whatever terminology you use there. I engage all sorts of people all the time. I spent 6 months reading and listening to everything Bart Ehrman ever said before I debated him.
Yeah.
John Dominic Crossan, exact same thing. And they're very different people, thankfully. Muslims, Roman Catholics, there is a vast difference between being able to enter into their way of thinking, listen to them speaking to each other, understanding them in their own context, and my saying, I'm going to lay aside my commitment to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. I'm going to pretend that I can exist outside of that commitment and saying that's necessary for me to understand what they're saying. No, it's not.
Yeah.
How would you demonstrate that it's necessary for me to lay those commitments aside to be able to understand what the other person is saying?
Yeah.
He doesn't even attempt to argue that.
By what standard would you say it's intellectually dishonest? And my question would be, at this point, Noah, with your position where you stand now, why should I care? Why should I be worried about that challenge at all? And so it loses its weight and strength when you step away from Christ. But I want to say this is vitally important to get. Jesus said to people who are following him, massive crowds, he turns around to them, it's an opportunity to grow the church. And he turns around to them, and he probably totally freaked out the disciples. They're thinking they're finally gaining some headway. He turns around and he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate, and he starts listing the closest people in their life, and he says, and even your own life, you're not worthy to be my disciple. He says, take up your cross, which means do the death march. You come ready to die and join me in this death. And that's the message of Jesus. Now, he wants to say, Jeff, as a Christian now, someone who believes in that Jesus, you need to put the cross down for just a bit.
Might offend him. That might scare him.
Right. Because you got to understand, you know, Jesus called to you to come and die and to hate all in comparison to him. That's radical, and you're not really going to step into these people's stories.
Incrementalism.
Yeah.
Incrementalism.
And my answer to that is that Jesus calls me to come and die, which means that I give up everything to follow Jesus. And I don't give up everything to follow Jesus and then turn around because of a challenge of a guy who's ultimately an apostate like Noah and say, well, let me go back and gather some of that stuff again. Let me go put my hands to the plow and then look back. that's not the message of the Christian faith. And I think that might sound radical to some people. That might sound just, well, that's just a huge commitment, Jeff. And I want to say that's the Lordship of Jesus Christ.
So it is.
Yep.
So it is.
Aimed at bringing people to share your perspective. And if you don't approach intellectual discourse, or in this case, a defense of the gospel, with at least some degree of meeting in the middle for the sake of conversation, then an intellectually honest conversation cannot be had. And this is...
We've demonstrated that's not the case.
That's right.
I mean, we're open about it. I'm open about it. But I'm not... I think if you're being dishonest when you pretend you can do that.
Yes.
And when in reality is you can't.
Literally the entire reason that people hate Cy Tenbrugg and Kate. Honestly, it's not because he's winning debates or because he's making people look like fools.
I think it's because he's Canadian. Just science.
You know, he has to be watching this right now.
Oh, yeah. It's because
you're Canadian.
It's maple syrup or something. I don't know what it is. Didn't you put maple syrup on the Arby's? I think we ate at Arby's sometime this year, and I think he put syrup on his sort of like Elf when he put maple syrup on his spaghetti.
Yes, and in Cy's defense, I want to say this. Cy is one of the sweetest people you will ever meet in your entire life.
Yes.
He has a rigorous commitment to Jesus Christ and his lordship and his word. Now, to the unbeliever, they may not like that. That may rub them the wrong way, because Cy, you know, he stands committed to Jesus. Now, he's not perfect. He would tell everyone he's not perfect, but that's the man. He's a very sweet, gracious man.
And, you know, in debates you may not see us, but you know, in just sitting around and talking with him, he's a very humble guy, too.
Yes, he is.
So, anyways.
Please. It's because this form of apologetics is inherently dishonest, and smart people are able to see through that inherent dishonesty. So to bring this back, setting Jesus apart as Lord seems to be synonymous with having an inability to reason with people wherever they're at in life. Instead, you reason at them. And so it's my sincere...
Reason at them.
Yeah.
So if you don't do the neutrality thing...
Yeah.
Then this is just bad.
Yeah. And he needs to understand, too, that if you read any book on presuppositional apologetics, you're going to read about the twofold apologetic methodology. And what is that twofold apologetic methodology? Is one, Proverbs 26, verse 4, don't answer the fool according to their folly. That's a command. Okay, don't do it. But lest you be like unto them. But the second part is to answer the fool according to their folly, lest they be wise in their own conceit. We're actually called to step into what their folly is and answer them according to it, which would, I think, necessitate understanding them. Understanding where they're coming from, so we can reason from within that sphere and that framework. And so what I try desperately to do is, if I'm reasoning with a Mormon, I can't tell you, Dr. White, how many countless hours of debates, lectures, I mean, my time in reading books to understand their position, to fully grasp it and to even grapple with it.
Whatever it is anymore.
Yeah, and same with Jehovah's Witnesses and with atheists. I've read The God's Illusion. I've read... goodness, you name the book, Harris's books, I've read Dennett's books, I've read stuff from Hitchens, I've listened to so many hours of Hitchens that I actually love the man. I have an affection
for
him.
You do know I was scheduled to debate him.
I couldn't wait. I was so upset when it didn't happen. But let me just say this, this may not have a lot of meaning for Noah, but I have done my very best to make sure that I understand the people that I'm talking to understand their position, the way that they see the world. I've read their books. I've spent countless hours doing so. And I've had a lot of encouragement from you. The thing you've said for many years is that we have to accurately represent our opponents. And that has been my mantra, is to make sure that that is taking place. And so that's just not true. I'm going to just say, these are mere claims on Noah's part. It's just not that way.
Right. That this wildly myopic interpretation of, but in your hearts sanctify Christ as Lord, is being used to justify an apologetic that is basically inherently dishonest. And dishonesty is not a Christian virtue. But 1 Peter 3:15 is not the only verse that...
Okay. Right there, dishonesty is not a Christian virtue. And it is a wildly myopic reading of 1 Peter 3:15. First thought across my mind, Noah, since I know you're watching. Well, I don't actually know that. I don't have revelation on that.
Yeah, that's right.
But I have a feeling.
Yeah.
Rich is telling me that we've got a larger number than normal who are watching the stream today. Cannot develop this fully. I did a sermon, I remember, a presentation for Wretched Radio in Ohio a few years ago, where I unpacked this much more fully in the course of the entire hour. But 1 Peter 3:15, I have confessed that for many years, as an apologist, I didn't know what was going on in this verse. Because, yeah, you know, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts sounds like a nice, pious thing to do. But your attention immediately goes to the always being ready, pros apologian pantito aitunti humas logon perites en humin elpidos. Always being ready to give that reason defense. Everyone asking you a logon, a reason concerning the within you hope. And so you jump off from there and start, you know, trying to raise funds or something like that. And then, I don't remember how it happened or what the context was, but I noticed as I'm looking at the Nestle Allen 28th edition of the Greek New Testament in my lovely Accordance Bible software in front of me at the moment, that kurion and hagiosate are in italics. Now, I don't know why I hadn't noticed that before. It's right there in front of my eyes, but that's the way the mind works. And if it's in italics, that means the editor is saying this is a quotation from the Greek Septuagint, probably the Old Testament somewhere. And so I started doing what you're supposed to do, always supposed to do, and look at those backgrounds. And I didn't get the feeling that Noah has done this study. And to be honest with you, the vast majority of people that I know who use this, who would disagree with Noah, haven't done this study either, so he can't exactly be faulted for that. But what I am going to fault you for, Noah, is you have said that that interpretation that Jeff gave is myopic. Your criticism is myopic. You missed it. Bad place to miss it. In fact, all three places, bad place to miss it. This is a quotation that takes us back to an incredible series of texts beginning in Isaiah 7 all the way through Isaiah chapter 11. Don't have time to develop all of it. I just, only a few weeks ago on Sermon Audio, did a sermon at Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church on, and this is literally, I'd say maybe 2-3 weeks ago at most, I did a sermon on the Emmanuel text, the prophetic text from Isaiah 7 through 11. This comes from that section. It comes from Isaiah chapter 8 specifically. And the point is this, that when it says, kurion deton Christon hagiosate entais cardias humon. It's difficult to render this into English smoothly. But it says, kurion, which is in, when it's being quoted out of the Greek Septuagint, is about Yahweh. The command is being given to treat Yahweh as holy, to set him apart as holy. Don't listen to the people around you. Go back to Isaiah 8, you can see it for yourself. But instead, you are to treat Yahweh as holy. Here, Peter draws from, and a number of the New Testament writers draw from portions of this section of Isaiah as evidence. Paul pulls this out. Seems awfully clear that when Jesus had that post-resurrection conversation with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and then he opens the disciples' minds to understand that from Moses all the way through the prophets, they all testified to me, etc., etc., that this is one of those texts that was opened up them, because it becomes, you know, the early church is just beating us. Psalm 110, obviously, the most often quoted of them. But kurios renders the Greek, the Hebrew tetragrammaton, Yahweh. And so what the original command was to sanctify in the sense of treat as holy Yahweh. Not the nations around or their gods or anything else, but treat as holy Yahweh. Here you have kurion deton Christon. So it's functioning positively. The Christ as Lord, as Yahweh, set apart, treat us holy, and then the key is, and this is where, with all due respect, you face planted, exegetically, antis cardiais humon, in your hearts. This is a willful act in the heart, the very seat, not of just emotion, that's what us Westerners think.
Yes.
But in the Greek concept, the very seat of the intellect, mind, will, it's the center of the human being. This is a command to treat as holy the Messiah as Yahweh. I mean, the whole incarnational theology, Trinity, everything is behind this. It would make no sense if Peter was not, as I said in the Forgotten Trinity, an experiential Trinitarian. In your hearts, in that place where you prioritize, where you decide what is most important and what is less important. In other words, in your making of what we would call today your worldview. How you deal with all of life is to be focused upon the fulfillment of this command. And I've admitted, I've misused this text for years. Until I realized the only person who is truly ready to engage, the only person who is going to cause people, ever notice, give a defense to whom? Those who ask you. Why are they asking you? Because when you make this arrangement in your heart, you're going to react so differently, speak so differently, act so differently than the world around you. You're going to react to tragedy differently. You're going to react to difficulties differently. And the result is people are going to come to you and ask you, where did you get this hope? And it is the fact that you have put Christ in the center as Yahweh in the entirety of your life that results in your being asked, where did you get this hope? Now, you may go, well, I don't see what that has to do with epistemology. And if you do, then you're ignoring the New Testament teaching on the nature of man, because man is a whole.
Yeah.
And you're missing Peter's entire point, which is to encourage Christians in the midst of persecution. Remain focused. How do you remain focused? You've got to have a focus upon who Jesus Christ is and who he truly is and who we are in light of that. You weren't giving a myopic interpretation. You were giving an appropriate interpretation that recognizes what it's all about. And unfortunately, Noah missed that.
Yeah, and I can't really add anything to that except to say that if we're told to set Christ apart as Yahweh in our hearts, always being ready to give a reasoned defense, I have to say this. It should be obvious. It's obvious as the nose on our face. If Jesus is Yahweh, Yahweh makes certain claims about the world that affect how you view ontology, epistemology, ethics, all those systems. And so it's meaningful to set Jesus apart as Yahweh, and it affects everything else I believe about the world. And so if there's no real connection between Jesus being Yahweh and my apologetic, I want to say 1 Peter 3:15 makes no sense.
Well, not only that, but hagiazo, to treat as holy,
yes,
to set apart as holy. This is placing, recognizing his place and hence recognizing my place as the one who is subservient to him, is to serve him. Again, it is an entire radical Christian worldview that we're also going to see in Romans and Colossians.
Yes.
It's consistent.
Yep.
Very, very consistent. And we're going really, really slow. But we press on.
Yes.
It's to promote the idea that Christ is foundational to being able to have knowledge. The ace up your sleeve is Colossians 2:2, which says that their hearts may be encouraged, having been knit together in love and attaining to all the wealth that comes from the full assurance of understanding, resulting in a true knowledge of God's mystery, that is, Christ himself, in whom are hidden all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Now, here's how you interpret that passage.
He says, I want their hearts to be encouraged and joined together in love so that they may have
Who's the really skinny guy up there at the? Put that back up, Rich. Who's
oh no!
And
oh,
look,
wow.
And he's it doesn't look bearded or
no, it's a baby beard.
It's a baby beard.
It's a baby beard.
Who is that? Wow. I love when people do this. But yeah. See, people can do this to me all the way back into the 90s.
I know.
I've seen
the videos.
That's ugly.
Yeah, I've seen the videos.
it's like, but wow, look at that.
Yeah.
Man, how long ago was this?
It was about 4 or 5 years ago.
4 or 5 years?
That was, check this out. This was about 4 days after a major nose surgery.
Really?
And I...
Oh, yeah, you can sort of see that. Huh?
Yeah, my face is puffed up.
Yeah.
I had made the commitment, and I was like, my wife said, there's no way you can do this. You just had a major surgery. You're like, I was like, I couldn't even get out of bed. And I just begged God, God, give me strength for 1 hour. And so, in reality, this is a real gift from God to me that I could actually do this little thing here. So.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Well, now I feel really bad pointing that out. Okay.
That's okay. All the riches of assured understanding and have the knowledge of God's mystery, Christ. Now listen closely to this. All the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Him. It seems like sort of a powerful statement and a passing statement, but it's everything when it comes to how do we know what we know, how do we defend the faith. Listen to what it says again. He says, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Christ. That's a major statement. That's an epistemological statement that is huge. He's saying, how do you truly know anything? You want to know where all the wisdom and all knowledge is at? It's in Jesus. He's a source of all wisdom and all knowledge. And this is a passage most of you guys probably already know.
So to you, this is an epistemological statement. In fact, it's the beginning of any kind of epistemology. How do you truly know anything at all? Well, it's Jesus. Greg Bahnsen, who definitely had an influence on you, I can see, says in his book, Presuppositional Apologetics, Stated and Defended, the teaching of Colossians 2:3-8 is unambiguous. All knowledge, note not simply knowledge of religious matters, is to be found in Christ. Bahnsen goes on to say, all wisdom and knowledge is deposited in the person of Christ, whether it be about the War of 1812, Water's chemical composition, the literature of Shakespeare, or the laws of logic. Every academic pursuit and every thought must be related to Jesus Christ, for Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Okay, so who is Paul writing to in Colossians? What's the context here? Paul's writing to a church that's being negatively influenced by pagan cults and false teachings. The church there is entrenched in mysticism and in bad philosophies that are...
Now, I'm wondering, it would be nice if I could see some sources, because there's actually a lot of discussion as to the nature of the teaching. Proto-Gnosticism is an early form of Gnosticism. It clearly is using the same terminology, gnosis, pleroma, you know, all the terminologies there. It doesn't really seem that has entered into the church in the sense of like in Galatia quite yet, but it is a danger that he is aware of. It's been reported to him, and so he's speaking of this. But it's going to be very interesting to see how Noah pretends that noting the historical context allows for the utter diminishment of the vast application of the statement
right. That
is going to follow.
Impugning Christ's divinity. So in effect, Christ's deity is being challenged, and so Paul is responding with this letter. Paul's aim is to make Christ central and to argue that he's the Lord over all wisdom, and that he, in effect, trumps all of these other various vain philosophies, and that it's through seeking him that one actually finds all of the treasures of knowledge and wisdom. Things that are...
Now, does that mean that Christ is only trumps this particular range of claims of wisdom?
Yeah.
Or is it all claims of wisdom because of what happened in Colossians 1, where it says, for by him were
all things
created, whether in the heavens, the earth, visible, invisible, principalities, powers, dominions, or authorities, all things created by him. He's before all things. In him, all things sunestiken. They have their... Now, is that just limited to Proto-Gnosticism in the first century?
Yep.
I mean, that is a claim that Jesus is the creator of the entire created universe, because that was a smack in the face to a Gnostic.
Yep.
Because if you understand Gnosticism, then you understand that they believed that there was a pure, holy, spiritual God that could never have created this evil universe.
Yeah.
Spirit is good. They're dualists. Material is evil. And so you have these eons that come down that makes up the Pleroma, and eventually you get far enough down, you have a demiurge who is Jehovah, and he's still powerful enough to create, but he's far enough away from the true God that he can create the physical universe. And what Paul is doing is he is smacking proto-Gnosticism into pieces by saying, you can't make some room in here in the Pleroma for Jesus. He is the one who made it all. That's his statement. How can you limit that? How is that not relevant to any other philosophical statement regarding origins for a Christian?
Yeah. If Jesus made the world and everything in it, if he holds it all together, if there's nothing that exists that wasn't created by him, if he did all that, then that means that has something to say in the area of philosophy and metaphysics. And again, it's everything and encompasses everything. And I want to say this is confusing to me because Noah said something to the effect of here that what Paul is doing, this is Noah's explanation of what Paul's saying in Colossians 2. He's saying that Christ trumps all vain traditions and philosophies.
Does that mean all? Or
and when I heard him say that, I thought... Yeah. What are you attacking at this point? Because it sounds like you've granted
right. The
basic supposition behind what we're saying. Now, again, not all of what we're saying in presuppositional apologetics or covenantal apologetics is wrapped up in these three texts. There's so much more. But if you grant that Paul is doing that there, haven't you given it all away? Haven't you just admitted that interpretation is correct?
Pretty much. I don't see how you can get around it.
Reported to be obtained in these other hollow traditions. Everything in these passages is about raising Christ up over these other traditions. It's not a philosophical text about the problem of epistemological grounding, right?
No, wait a minute. So, if you take this perspective, this is again where Noah had some massively weak theology as a quote-unquote Christian, which might explain a lot of where he is now. Unfortunately, it's sad. You don't have to have a text, specifically having a subtext, a subtitle that says, we are now going to discuss philosophical epistemology, for it to be relevant.
That's right.
If you have just said that Christ is the creator of all things, that he is before all things, that all things exist for him, that in him all things synestake him, they have their subsistence, he holds it all together. He is the maker and creator of all things. How can that not have the deepest epistemological significance of any statement you could ever make?
That's right.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
This was respectfully, it was bad.
Well, the acts of Jesus.
It was bad.
Yeah,
it was, and the implications he draws.
Yes.
It was bad.
It was bad. But the point is, people will hear that and they might resonate with that. Many of the best evidences for such things as the deity of Christ come from texts that are not specifically arguing about that subject at all. Some of the strongest evidence is how Jesus refers to himself in other contexts. So it's just, it is a absolutely naive concept of exegesis to approach it in this way.
Paul is not Quine, and his letter to the Colossians is not a response to Carnap. This isn't about epistemology. Read the rest of the passage. Paul admonishes the church to live their lives rooted in Jesus. It's about...
He started too far in.
Yeah.
If you read Colossians 2, 3 through 8, in light of chapter 1 and what was said there...
Yeah.
This whole thing falls apart.
Yes, it does.
It now becomes, well, he's just telling the Christians to live together in a nice... No, he's not.
And when he says, Paul's telling Christians to live their lives rooted in Jesus.
Yeah, why?
Great, thank you.
Right.
So when I engage in philosophy and apologetics, do I get to continue to live my life rooted in Jesus? Or are you going to take that away from me when I do it because it makes you uncomfortable?
And might make the unbeliever uncomfortable.
And might make them uncomfortable. So,
yeah.
So are you saying that as a Christian I should be inconsistent with Paul's call there? Because that's what you grant he's telling Christians to do. So do I live consistently with that? Live my life rooted in Jesus? Or do I abandon my being rooted in Jesus for the sake of the comfort of the unbeliever? It becomes this real mess that Noah's created in the text, where the text cannot just mean what it means on the face of it. And so it's just difficult to wrap my mind around really what his criticism is. But I'm not sure. Does he get to verse 8 here? I don't know, where he says, see to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to the human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ.
I mean, that is about as clear as you can get.
Boy, if that's not about epistemology and philosophy, I don't know what is.
I don't know either. I mean, that is, and then of course, well, and let's notice, rooted, grounded in him, as you have been taught, abounding in the word of thanksgiving. Then the you have the term dia tes philosophias. Mm-hmm. There's philosophy, kenes. So philosophy, love of knowledge, would be non-kenes if it's based on the one who made all things, I suppose,
yeah.
Christian philosophy. And then, rather than according to Christ, and what are the very next words? Hati en auto katoikai pantalate roma te seatitas somaticos. For in him is dwelling all the fullness of deity in bodily form. Why do we subject all of man's philosophies, all of man's teachings, all of man's traditions to Jesus Christ? Because he's God incarnate.
Yep.
That's why.
That's right. That's right.
Noah, you didn't deal with Colossians 2, my friend. Colossians 2 dealt with you.
Yes.
That's... I don't have a mic to drop. Here's a tribble. There, okay? How's that? We dropped the tribble.
Notice, though, I think for the brothers and sisters that are listening to this and really starting to engage this.
There are people listening to this?
There are.
Oh.
I want to say that notice that Paul says here there's a philosophy that is not according to Christ.
Right.
Which means that there is a philosophy that is
according
to Jesus. And what Paul is trying to arm Christians with is what's necessary to avoid falling prey to those things. I mean, the word there is to be robbed.
Mm-hmm.
To be robbed. And Paul does not want Christians to be robbed by philosophy and empty deceit according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ.
So you're talking about taking captive?
Yeah, taking captive.
Right. That is something that you have to have a basis to be able to resist that. I assume you mean robbing in the sense of taking someone as a captive and taking them away.
Yes.
And the only foundation that Christians are given to resist that is a recognition of who Jesus Christ truly is.
That's right.
And if you think theology is just over there and your philosophy is over here, well, you might end up as an agnostic on YouTube.
That's right. And I think that Dr. White is where this is coming from. He had a very, very substandard, to say the least, view of a biblical epistemology, a view of Jesus,
anthropology,
a view of us.
Consistency of theology.
And that's where this comes from. So the critique comes really from the bad understanding he had, unbiblical view of God and man that he had before he abandoned faith.
Yeah.
Primacy of Jesus in light of an increasingly pagan and heretical context. To treat this as though it were implying or that it should be interpreted as an epistemological grounding for all of human knowledge is to so wildly divorce this passage from its context that it should scare anyone who takes exegesis seriously.
Okay, now just listen to what we just said.
Yeah.
We just went to chapter 1, follow it through, go to verses 8 and 9, which absolutely nail it down. He didn't do either of those things, but we're the ones engaging in cult apologetics.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, there's a sense of irony here because it's this kind of interpretation that is what cult apologetics is all about, right? One of the things we're supposed to watch out for is divorcing verses from their historical and authorial context and extracting these kinds of...
One of the things we're supposed to do. We're supposed to. This is where I think that something needs to be said about integrity. He's speaking in the present tense. One of the things we're supposed to do in cult apology, as we minister to the cult, kind of an idea. It's like, no, you gave it all up, Noah. You're no longer a Christian. And yet, for some reason in this video, you're giving people the impression that you are.
Yeah.
Why not just have integrity? Why not start the video saying, look, I used to be this, you know, I've left the faith, I don't believe anymore, I'm not a Christian any longer, but these are my critiques of what Jeff says.
As coming from my worldview now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have a great deal of respect for that.
Yeah, I would too.
I really would.
I would too, yeah.
Descriptive statements that have nothing to do with the original passage. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking a passage that's clearly about Christ's dominance over other vain traditions and then decontextualizing it and treating it as though it's though Paul has solved the fundamental problem in epistemology. And so again, you're reading...
Did Paul solve the... Well, Paul didn't have to solve it. God solved it in the incarnation.
Yeah.
In his own revelation. Definitely.
Suppositionalism into the passage. You're not extracting this from the text. You're giving it to the text. And
now, I think we've pretty much 100% refuted that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just, it's done.
And let me just say, I identify as a presuppositionalist because the text drove
right.
me to it.
Right.
I was not a presuppositionalist when I really moved forward. I wasn't raised a Christian. I went to a Bible college that taught me. My texts were Norman Geisler's books.
Mm-hmm.
I was an evidentialist, and it was years later that I got my theological teeth kicked in when I realized that I was going to these texts and texts like them, and I was not really fully embracing those truths and living consistently with them. It was a real change of mind for me
mm-hmm.
to really see the lordship of Jesus in every area, including my thinking. And it was the text that drove me there.
Yep. Same here.
Absurdities, like in your video where you say reverence submission to God is first before there is any knowledge, wisdom, or anything. Now that's prima facie absurd. I can learn to drive a car, for example, without being in reverent submission to God. I can learn to do my taxes without being in reverent submission to God. I can even know that God exists without being in reverent submission to God.
Well, and this is what's important to point out here, is that there is so-called knowledge, there is a pseudo-wisdom, there is a borrowed capital kind of wisdom that every image-bearer of God has. This is one of the things that Van Til would say. He'd say, and as long as we're talking about presuppositional apologetics, let's go back to one of the great people that distilled it. Unbelievers can count. Sometimes they can count better than Christians.
True.
They can do their books. They can do accounting. They can do their taxes better than Christians. They can do arithmetic. But they cannot account
for
their counting. And one of the things that unbelievers can do is live like an image bearer of God in God's world, regardless of whether or not they submit to Him. And so that needs to be granted. There is common ground with all of us. We talked about this in the beginning. There are certain things that unbelievers do because they are undeniably in the image of God and inescapably in the image of God. And what's important here to note is that you cannot account for knowledge. You cannot make sense of any wisdom or epistemological system apart from God. If you don't have God, you can't make sense of the world.
So the problem with the attack is in his understanding of what true knowledge means.
That's right.
When you were talking about true knowledge, you're talking about knowledge that exists consistently within a worldview that gives it its proper meaning and place.
That's right.
Rather than putting you in the center, which you can't be in the center. You're insufficient to function as the center. You're insufficient to be the definition of all these things.
Yeah.
And so you weren't saying that every unbeliever is an idiot.
Or that they walk around with nothing in their heads and they just sort of go along in life.
Right.
There's nothing in there. No, they're making claims. They have beliefs. They have commitments. They know stuff. I'm sure I've flown a lot. You've flown a lot. I'm sure I've had atheist pilots.
Oh, yes.
That have flown me around the world.
Yes.
And thank God for that and good atheist pilots. But the point is here's a good example. I'm sure atheist pilots fly me around the world. But I thank God that they weren't acting consistently with their atheism when they were flying me. I thank God that they were dependent upon a uniform universe, that they believed in induction, that the laws of math held together while they were flying from one place to the next, that the laws of speed and, you know, all those different things, the physical constants all held together. And I thank God that they knew they had a moral responsibility for the 250 souls on board. They knew that they had an ought behind making sure we arrived safely.
And we should pray that God would be merciful to them because they are then responsible God for all those gifts that he has given them.
That's right. And so the point is that you cannot really have any basis for justified true belief. You can't have a basis for knowledge, for wisdom, any of those things apart from first a submission to God. It's not going to make sense. I'll give you an example. So we had Dan Barker on the radio program a long time back. And he's making all these claims
Not as long ago as I did.
No, I know. Yeah. I've listened to all the beginning of the discussions.
We're talking. Did you ever hear the ones on the Tom Likas show?
The radio program. I heard a radio show with you and
I. I was like 21 or 22. Or
yes.
Like that. That was ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah, I've listened to, I think, probably everything you've done. we're in the show with Dan Barker. And on the show with Dan Barker, he's just, you know, challenging God, challenging Christians, immoral and stupid and idiotic and illogical and all these different things. And he's supreme atheist, you know, like we have the better morality, the better, you know, view of logic.
Certainly the better intellect.
Yeah, and as we began to sort of like chop away at the foundations and keep pointing him to his feet, by the end of the program, I just pointed out to him, so in your view, basically, it's not really wrong to rape a woman, is it? He said, in the cosmic picture, it won't matter.
Cosmic broccoli, man.
Yeah, that's what...
Cosmic broccoli.
But that's the point, is that you can make claims as an atheist and say, oh, this is immoral and this is wrong and we ought to be doing this, but when you really get down to the foundation, the atheist goes, yeah, we don't really need those.
Yeah.
In the end, it doesn't matter. And that's the point. It's a so-called knowledge. It's so-called wisdom. It's not true wisdom. It's not consistent.
Quickly, because we've got to get to Romans 1, but Valerie in Twitter said, few people know that in addition to Joseph, Jacob also gave coats of many colors to his two nephews, James and Jeff.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Rich, you know what that, I don't know if you can see Rich.
I can.
The look on his face right there is, stop encouraging him!
Don't help me.
slight break in the criticism there. We press on because we got to get to Romans 1.
We start to see how these poorly exegeted passages rise to really, really absurd statements like this. I mean, this is not clear thinking. This is very muddled logic. But the most insidious interpretation I've seen from you comes from what you feel the Bible has to say about non-believers.
In Romans chapter 1, the Bible says that God has made himself evident to everybody. That the problem of mankind is never intellectual, it's never a lack of evidence, ever. The problem is and always will be, for them and for me outside of Christ, not intellectual, not lack of evidence, but it is always suppression of truth. It says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. For that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Question, who made it evident to them? God did. Now, if God sends the message, guys, does it get through? Yes.
I don't know, Jeff. Did the Jews always get the message when God spoke through the prophets? Or what about in the days of Noah? I mean, even Jesus said in Luke, if they don't listen to Moses or the prophets, they won't be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. So even Jesus knew that God's message always doesn't get through to people. Hell, even the disciples were confused about what he, the Son of God, was saying half the time. And it was ironically Jesus himself who was ultimately hung on a Roman cross, in part because his message of the kingdom of God was thought to be a kind of call to political rebellion. So does God's message always get through? Well, not really. And so...
Well, because? Not really.
Pause.
Because?
Because?
Of sin and suppression of truth.
Not only that, but in Romans chapter 1, now he's about to read the whole thing, but the direct statement, and I mentioned in the exchange I had with him, I suggest to him, I said, you know, I included a fairly lengthy interpretation, exegesis, of Romans chapter 1. How long is this chapter? It starts on page 137 and goes to 165. So close to right at 30 pages, including the Greek text in justification, the God who justifies, and suggested he might want to take a look at that because
I was really amazed at the comments that he made here.
Yeah.
But the important thing is, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for hotheos gar autois ephanerosen, God made it evident to them, and the result of this in verses 20 and 21 is that being understood, see what is it, having been clearly seen, the result clause is they are anapologetus. Mm-hmm. They are without an apologetic. They are without an excuse. The clear, direct assertion of the Apostle Paul in Romans 1 is that the revelation gets through.
Yeah.
That man is held accountable for honoring God as God and giving thanks to God. They know that that his divine power and attributes exist. I don't think they, you know, there's all sorts of special revelation that is, I don't believe in the gospel and the stars and stuff like that.
Right.
But the point is, Paul's assertion, he's disagreeing with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Paul makes it plain. The revelation got through.
That's right.
The confusion of the apostles about the identity of the Messiah is not a refutation of Paul's assertion in Romans chapter 1,
right,
which specifically is, God's made it manifest, it's been clearly seen, they have no excuse.
Yeah, and that's my point in saying, because of sinful suppression, the witness gets through, the evidence gets through, because God is the one that has made it evident to them. When you bring up examples of people rejecting God and sin in history, it seems like a simple enough answer. That's because sin. It doesn't mean that God's message hasn't gotten through to them. It means that we are such rebels against the king that we act out in a number of different ways. And you can cite examples in history of people not supposedly not believing in God or rebelling against God. It doesn't contradict what God is saying here in Romans chapter 1, that he's made himself known to all of us.
No, but we're totally missing Romans 1, as it's about to be explained to us.
Imply that since God is the messenger, that his message always gets through is just flagrantly unbiblical. And I can give you 10 more examples of this. And it's this flagrantly unbiblical idea that's going to be foundational to the way that you actually approach non-believers. You interpret Romans to effectively mean that no one has sincere intellectual barriers to belief in God. Nobody. Which I guess makes things...
What sincere... The only way I can understand what he's saying here is that sincere intellectual barriers means neutral, honest, non-rebellious, uninfluenced by sin, I would believe in God if I just had enough evidence, mm-hmm, if I could just get over this particular objection type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think it was about here I was starting going, this is the pagan Christian apologist, because I was still going, is this, you know, he sounded like a Christian apologist at first anyways.
Yeah.
Because there's no Christian anthropology here at all. There's no understanding of what sin does or
yep,
what Romans 1's about or anything like that at all.
Yeah.
And then he simplifies it. You know, because I understand there's all sorts of different intellectual objections, but they have a source.
Yes.
Because we're made in the image of God.
Yeah.
And that, if you don't see it, we're made in the image of God.
Very easy for you as an apologist, because you don't have to do any intellectual heavy lifting, if that's true. See, this is why.
Oh, that's why you're doing right, all this, Jeff, is that you don't have to do any intellectual heavy lifting. You leave the intellectual heavy lifting to the evidential philosophers.
Yeah.
That's, oh, man, I should have fast-forwarded 18 minutes in. We wouldn't have had to do all the rest of this stuff.
Yeah, no, I understand that there are lots of things going on in this text and also in the world as it's manifested. I recognize that Romans chapter 1 says certain things about God and man, and I understand that that's going to work its way out in many different ways. Now, I don't simply say, oh, that's just sin. I'm happy to say, well, I know what's really going on here, because God has given revelation right, that this is what's going on. It's sin, a sinful expression of truth. And then I have to, as a Christian apologist, work through the system itself to critique it. I would just point people to the last debate we had with the atheists at the Bonson Conference. That debate, from my perspective, at least on my part, was not me simply saying, well, that's just sin. I tried to deal with all of their arguments and their claims as much as I was able in the very short time we were given to show the absurdity of it. I talked about logic with them. I talked about their view of, I think, uniformity in nature. I talked and engage with them in their own arguments. I didn't just simply say in the 3 hours that we were there, it's just sin, it's just sin. Yeah. I recognize that sin manifests itself in our experience in a number of different ways. For some people, it's alcoholism, it's a love of drugs and alcohol, some people it's sex, some people it's an atheistic persuasion that moves its way throughout their life. Some people, it's Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses. There's all kinds of ways that we create idols in exchange for the true God.
For the lies. Lots of different lies.
There's lots of different lies, and there's lots of different ways that it comes out.
It's coming up on 2 hours.
Yes, and I have to use the bathroom. All this tea you gave me, I'm like, thanks, Dr. White. So
what I'm going to need to do, let's let him... finish the Romans 1 thing.
Okay.
And then we will give a summary response to all the Romans 1 thing.
Okay.
And we'll call it good.
Okay.
Sound good? All right,
yep.
Let's do it.
Suppositional apologetics feels so cheap to intellectual people, even Christians. See, if it's not really intellectual reservations that non-regenerate people are having, then you don't have to spend the time helping them walk through their intellectual problems with Christianity. You just get to blame sin and stay intellectually distant. So here's what Romans 1 actually says, starting at verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known of God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. But it doesn't stop there. If you were to continue reading the passage, it goes on to say, "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error." So now we have a problem. Romans 1 is not talking about atheists or people who disbelieve in God. Paul is purposefully singling out a particular group of people engaging in idolatry. There's imagery of temple prostitution and idols, acts of men sleeping with men and women sleeping with women. He's referring to Gentiles who were entrenched in pagan practices. So what you've done is you've taken a verse in which Paul is speaking about one specific group of people, you've decontextualized it and made it applicable to all people. Notice how there's a continuity of this "they" that Paul is referring to in this passage. It's the same group of people throughout the body of Romans 1, 18 through 32. The same "they" that are without excuse and are privy to God's manifestation are the same "they" that burn for lust with the same sex. So this is clearly not meant to apply to everyone, or specifically just to atheists, because not all atheists are men liking men and women liking women. This passage is an indictment of a certain type of sacrilege in which pagans, who Paul is arguing already know that God exists, instead choose to worship idols. See, there were fertility cults at the time that involved sex between males and eunuch prostitutes. This is what Paul refers to towards the end of the verse when he talks about men sleeping with other men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. It's the same group of people that's being addressed in the passage where God's revelation is made manifest. So this verse is not meant to apply to everyone on the planet. So that part of your apologetic in which you approach all non-believers with the assumption that they already know that God exists and they're just suppressing the truth is lazy. It's not supported by the scriptures in Romans like you think that it is. And most importantly, it's dangerous and it's antithetical to your goal of evangelism. Jeff, you have tattoos, right? Now, if I was to point out to you Leviticus 19:28, which says, "You shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead or tattoo yourselves," how do you think you would respond to me? Perhaps that we're no longer under the Levitical law. Well, then I guess that prescription had a particular audience and a particular time frame in which it was relevant. Or perhaps it was just for the Jews to separate themselves from the pagans. Well, then I guess that prescription had a particular audience and a particular time frame in which it was relevant. Now, I could just as easily take this specific Bible verse that's talking about one particular group of people, decontextualize it, and apply it to you as a new audience. But to do that would be eisegetical, not exegetical. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that there aren't truths that can be extracted from biblical passages that are contained within a context and then apply it across the board. There are a lot of passages in the Bible that aim to convey a moral precept or a theological truth through a parable or a story or a teaching, but this is not one of them. Paul in Romans 1 is writing to Jews and referring specifically to pagan Gentiles who were entrenched in idolatry. See, here's why what you're doing is dangerous, Jeff. What's going to happen is that one of the people that you're teaching at your church is going to go become friends with an atheist. And that atheist is going to have real sincere intellectual reservations, either about belief in God or the veracity of the Bible. It could be really about anything. And after many conversations and many back and forths, that Christian in your class is going to really get the message that it actually is about intellectual problems for some people. And when this happens, the Christian who sat through your class and heard you teach the things that you're teaching is going to come to doubt the Bible. Because if the Bible really does teach that it's all a sin problem, and no one really has any intellectually sincere reservations, this is going to clash with the real world, because this is not the way the world really is.
All right. Now, you can go on later on to talk about how he spent all this time doing this exegesis, all we do is eisegesis, so on and so forth. You've got a bunch of notes there. You keep those things in mind.
Okay.
I want to address the fundamental collapse as far as exegesis goes here. Some of you saw my debate with Dr. Graham Codrington in South Africa, Johannesburg, a few weeks ago. And you're going, hey, I've heard this someplace before. And you have. What we just heard was that there's one particular group in Romans 1:18-32 doing all this stuff. Really? It is so painfully obvious, Noah, that what you have at the end of the chapter is one of Paul's vice lists. Do you really think that Paul had one particular narrow group in mind of people who did everything? They murdered their parents? They were all thieves? They did everything in that list, and they were all homosexuals. All the females were lesbians, and all the males were homosexuals. And that's the group we're talking about. Really? That is, to use your term, insane and absurd. And you should have known better, and you should never have put that out on YouTube. Because that is so patently, obviously, not the case. Paul is not saying that every person does every single one of these things. These are all manifestations of the exchange of the truth of God for the lie. And so in some people that results in homosexuality. In some people it results in other manifestations. But here's the drop the tribble moment, okay?
Drop the tribble moment.
Yeah. I'm not going to drop microphones. They're too expensive. I'm going to drop the tribble. It's supposed to do that. Here's the problem, Noah. If you're going to pretend to do exegesis, sorry, that was snarky, but that's what you're doing. If you're going to pretend to do exegesis, then be prepared to answer for it. Because when you get to Romans 3, you see, Paul gives us a pretty clear understanding of his intentions. And in Romans chapter 3, after he gives this long list, remember verses 10 and following through about verse 18? There's no fear of God before their eyes. I know those are all quotations from the Psalter primarily, and you could say they're all about Jews if you wanted to. They're really not. But what's Paul's interpretation? His interpretation is that what he's done in Romans 1, 2, and 3 has been to demonstrate the universal sinfulness of man. He says, we conclude that Jews and Gentiles are all, their mouths are closed. They're all guilty before God. And then he's able to introduce the gospel. Well, where did he do that?
He started in chapter 1. That's the universal condition of man with its various manifestations. Chapter 2, he then turns to the Jew, who's sitting there going, oh yeah, give it to him, give it to him. And he says, mere possession of the law doesn't make you right before God. You who rob temples, you know robbing temples is wrong, but if you do it yourself, then you're a hypocrite. And so that list in chapter 3 is again descriptive of all of mankind, so that every mouth is closed, is what Paul says. So you have gone against Paul's own interpretation in concluding that section and how he makes application of it. I'm sorry. That is an abject failure in doing any meaningful exegesis. You didn't do anything with the exchange. You did not enter into that text at all. Because if you do, it is going to absolutely destroy your entire critique, because what Romans 1 is saying is all mankind does suppress that knowledge. In different ways, it manifests itself in many different ways. It's not the simplistic way that you have attributed to Jeff and to those of us who do presuppositional apologetics.
Yep. And I want to say there's a bit of a problem with how he describes how I teach people at church to do apologetics. There's going to be a problem, Jeff. You can teach people, they're going to meet atheists,
right,
sincere intellectual barriers, and you know, if you're just saying it's just sin, then they're going to realize it's wrong. Well, anybody who goes to apologetics at church, or anybody who's ever learned apologetics from me, would never have thought that I just taught it's just sin. And you just need to know it's just sin, guys. Ignore it all. No, we engage with their system, and we engage with their arguments. I mean, I hand out copies of where we got our Bible from. How do we know that we have those texts transmitted to us, that God's actually preserved his word? You've done a little bit of work on that. You know, these are the things that people learn in apology at church. They learn about where we got our Bibles from, the manuscript tradition, how we actually work through that tradition to get back to the text, and that's what they learn. And so we do learn to handle the intellectual barriers someone might have to faith, but we recognize in the end that what is going to open somebody's eyes is not the argument. It's not the, look at the manuscript tradition, look at the biological complexity of life, look at the irreducible complexity of life. We recognize that the ultimate problem for anybody is sin. We're rebels against our Creator, and we need to have our eyes open. We need to have,
A new heart.
A new heart. And so in the end, it's about the gospel, and it's about salvation. Nobody hears from me, guys, it's just sin. It's not intellectual problems. Here's the point. I actually want to argue, Noah, that apart from Christ and the biblical worldview, you can't handle intellectual objections, because you can't look at history with any kind of meaning or providence. You can't even look at the future with any kind of hope or coherence, because if you don't have Christ, you have no basis for intellectual barriers to even answer any problems, to talk about, again, logic or reason or any kind of coherent epistemology. And so I think that you need God to even talk about answering intellectual barriers.
Well, he's going to say, well, that was what the rest of the video was about.
Yeah.
That's going to be the response to that.
Yeah. Well, we only have 2 hours now. We've dealt with 3 pastors he went through, and so...
Yeah, well, we got 23 minutes out of... There's only 21 left, so we got over halfway through.
But I will say, in response to Leviticus, if somebody said, Jeff, you have tattoos, what about Leviticus? I would say, anybody got any kind of stuff for the dead going on? Any kind of worship of ancestors?
I explained that just a few weeks ago.
This is not about worship of ancestors. If you read the text itself, I would say dig into the text exegetically, and you realize that this was not for the dead or any ancestor worship.
No.
So that's why I would tell people not to worry about that. I would do it exegetically. I wouldn't say...
And you'd also point out that Ka is a hapax legomena. It's a disputed hapax legomena. The Deuteronomistic parallels, Deuteronomy 14:1.
Yeah.
It all has to do with the dead, etc.
Yeah. And if somebody said, Jeff, that kooji, is it 2 different kind of fibers? Because it sure looks like it. I would say, you bet, this is all kinds of different fibers.
Yeah, that definitely is probably... I think that's actually mercerized cotton. You might actually
okay.
You might be halal.
Okay.
It might be cool.
Okay.
I'm not sure about this one, but definitely. Well, anyway, my hope, obviously, in spending 2 hours and 15 minutes on this subject is that people have been
allowed to think through things. You know, answering objections in formats like this, I think one of the advantages of this format of doing a program, not only are you letting the other side speak, you're hearing what their objections really are, but you're forced to interact with what they're saying. If you skip over what they're saying, you know, you're going to go, oh, you didn't, you know. But it's just like a debate. It allows for the two positions to be brought together, and hence clarity. And we want our people, I know you want your people at your church. I just got a text from somebody at my church saying, you need to preach on that 1 Peter 3:15 text. I responded back, I have.
Yeah, you sure have.
I have, actually. And there, even. We want our people to be ready to engage. You know, this last objection that he gave, you know, you're going to go out there and find out atheists are different than what you've been saying. I really, you know, a lot of them that are sitting there were atheists. They well know that's all about.
That's right. Place.
So I hope you've enjoyed having an opportunity to respond.
Yeah.
I hope that maybe you'll find the time to do some more. It's only halfway through, and the rest of it is the non-exegetical stuff. And it's not that that's not important. It just seemed to me, especially with the strange approach of making it sound like that kind of stuff, that was the most important thing to deal with. Yep. You'd think that someone who was a Christian, but we're not dealing with it.
Yeah, and his argument is that, Jeff, your foundations, presuppositionalist, your foundations are wrong if you're basing it on these texts, and here's why. Well, if we've demonstrated exegetically that, Noah, you're wrong about that, and we're on proper biblical footing here, then that means that the rest of your critique is also going to fall apart because...
From a biblical worldview.
From a biblical perspective.
But see, that's why I think he's most important about, most concerned about that part, is because that's really not where he is anymore.
Right. And my hope is, and I mean this with all my heart, my hope is that Noah would turn from sin to Christ.
Indeed.
And he would experience life. Real life and forgiveness and peace with God. I would offer this to Noah as something he needs to hear. The Bible says they went out from us in order to show that they were not of us. And Noah, I would encourage you to think very, very, very deeply about that, is that the Bible teaches that if you've abandoned the faith, you were never part of the faith to begin with. And I want to say this, would you please just think through this? I think that Dr. White and I can show you and demonstrate to you that your theology was off, your view of man was off, your view of Scripture was off, and that might have a lot to do with this false profession of faith that he had. And so what I would encourage you to do is to really think about the majesty of Jesus Christ, the holiness of God, your own sin before a holy God, and the fact that you will be held accountable before a holy God for your sin, just like me and just like Dr. White would be outside of Jesus. And I would call you to come to the one who died, who was buried and rose again, and to turn from your sin to the living God, to put your faith in Christ, to receive eternal life and salvation. In the end, all of this discussion, all of these arguments, they need to be kept over here in terms of like what's most important for me to you is that you turn from your sin to know Christ. And that's what I hope for you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate it. I didn't know how long we would go, but...
A while.
we've done 2:17 so far.
And it's been a party. We did
best
to make this as visually appealing.
I feel badly for Rich. He's still wearing plaid, but, you never know.
I feel badly, too.
This has been the most colorful video I've ever been a part of.
We
got to
do this every year. Every year at the time in December, we'll have a
Coogee party
here in the studio. Just got a no vote from Rich, but that doesn't matter. All right. Thanks for watching the program today. Lord willing, I'll be back. Wow, we're supposed to be back on Thursday when I will be an old, decrepit man, actually. My birthday.
Your birthday?
My birthday is Thursday, yep. So I'll bring in a cupcake or something, and it'll be a healthy one.
Okay.
We'll see you then. Thanks for watching. God bless.